This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Andrea Gale, do you read me? Do you read me? Come in! Come in, for God's sake, come in, Billy! These storms have collided! They are exploding!
Who is it?
That's Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio playing our guest, fishing boat captain Linda Greenlaw, in the film The Perfect Storm. Greenlaw says that her actual radio conversation with Captain Billy Tyne in 1991, believed to be the final contact made with the Andrea Gale before it disappeared in a storm, was less dramatic than the Hollywood version. But Greenlaw is a real commercial fisherman and the only female sword boat captain in the country. Sword fishing doesn't involve nets and trawling. During each fishing venture, Greenlaw and her crew will set thousands of individual hooks on a line and haul the massive creatures aboard one at a time. After years on the sea, Greenlaw left deep water fishing for 10 years to set lobster traps and write books. Her first, The Hungry Ocean, became a bestseller, and she's written 5 more books of fiction and nonfiction. Last year, she returned to the deep water. That voyage is the subject of her new book, Seaworthy, A Swordboat Captain Returns to the Sea. Greenlaw spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Linda Greenlaw, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, in this book, you write, the position of skipper aboard a U.S. Grand Banks longline vessel is the absolute pinnacle of the commercial fishing world. And I'd like you to begin by just telling us what longline deep water sword fishing is, how it works.
Well, longlining is, as the name would suggest, the fishery itself is fishing a very long line. A typical set, which we do every night while we're at sea, is 40 miles. We lay out a 40-mile single strand of 1,000-pound test line onto which we attach about 1,000 baited hooks. And that attachment's called the leader. It's suspended basically fairly close to the surface. And we fish temperature breaks, for instance, east of the Grand Banks, which is where most of my experience is. We fish where the Gulf Stream, which is to the south, pushes up into the Labrador Current, which is cold water. These temperature breaks are where all the feed collects, and where there's prey, there should be a predator. That's where we fish.
Okay. And so every day you have this big spool on the deck, and you just roll out 40 miles of line, and you have floats every so often, right, which I guess allow you to retrieve these things later. And you leave these 40 miles and 1,000 baited leader hooks out for several hours and then reel them in the next day, right?
Yes, that's correct. And swordfish are nocturnal in that they feed at night. They come close to the surface to feed at night. So we set the line out in the evening, and at daylight we pick up the end of the 40-mile string and start hauling it back.
I guess one question somebody would logically ask is, well, what happens if a boat crosses that 40-mile line?
And it happens often. It's called a part-off. And we have things called beeper buoys, which are electronic buoys transmitting frequencies that we can pick up in the wheelhouse of the boat with something called an automatic direction finder. So if we're hauling this 40-mile string and come to a bitter end or a part-off, the skipper will run up to the wheelhouse, tune in the next beeper buoy and sort of zero in on that, chase it down and hook back up and continue hauling.
So a boat will cut the line. It's close enough to the surface so that a boat will cut the line if it crosses it, right?
Yes, a deep draft ship like an oil tanker or something like that would certainly part it off. Can be parted off by sharks. Sometimes setting between the hot water and the cold water, stringing along this break, the cold water moves slower than the hot water, and sometimes the line just stretches beyond its tensile strength and parts off that way.
Okay. So now you got this crew of, you know, I guess 5 or 6 people on a boat that I guess in the case of the Seahawk, which you most recently were on, was like about, what, 63 feet?
Yes, 63-foot boat, and I had a crew of 5 men.
Right. So you have 5 people that are baiting 1,000 hooks a day, reeling them out. And then when you reel them back in, explain the process there and what you do when you have a swordfish or some other kind of fish on it.
Okay, well, hauling the gear back, it's all hands on deck, including the captain, and that's my favorite part of the job is hauling the gear because it's just like Christmas. You know, can't wait to see what you're going to get. Tie into the end in the morning and start hauling it. The captain drives the boat along the line, kind of following these floats, as you mentioned. And when the line gets tight or you feel some strain on it, that means you have some weight on a hook. You back the boat down, stop the boat, hopefully, and see what you have. It comes to a point when the snap or the thing that connects the hook to the main line when that breaks the surface, it's hand over hand hauling one man against one fish. And you hope it's a swordfish. Sometimes it's a shark, sometimes it's a tuna, sometimes it's mahi-mahi. But the target is swordfish. That's what we're all praying for.
And you can tell when it's a swordfish, right?
I can, yeah. I've been doing this a long time. I started swordfishing at the age of 19. So basically, I'm not fooled much when there's a little weight on the line. A swordfish acts totally different than a tuna or a shark.
Well, talk about that. How does a swordfish act?
A swordfish generally is pulling straight down. And when it gets close to the surface, it starts doing these circles. We call it a death circle, or we hope it's going to be a death circle and not a release circle. Tuna fish, often if you have the line in your hand, you feel a pump, pump, pump when it's pumping its tail. And you can really feel that if you have the line running through your hand. A shark generally does not dive down. It comes up to the surface, so the leader would be stretched out on the surface, and quite often you'd see a fin breaking the surface.
Now you got to get this thing aboard the boat. And I know from reading your book that there's a break in the gunwale, I mean the side of the ship, right? In effect, a door, right, where you can haul this. But it's still, you're talking about a 100-pound fish, right?
Yes. I mean, you're hoping it's a 100-pound fish. Last season, we had a 171-pound average. So these are big fish. And yes, there's a door cut in the side of the boat to make it a little easier to get the fish aboard. Basically, once the fish breaks the surface, you put gaffs in the fish to help pull it aboard. If it's a gigantic fish, we have a hydraulic lift that we can put a strap around the tail and pull the fish aboard that way.
Then what happens?
Once the fish is aboard the boat, the fish cleaner goes to work. It's very important for us to keep the quality of the fish really to high standards to get the money that we need to get for the fish to make a living. So the fish needs to be cleaned. That means, you know, the head comes off, the guts come out, salt water, rinse, and it gets packed on salt water ice immediately. Really important to get the fish chilled really quickly and not leave the fish on deck.
So every day, assuming that the weather is decent and things are working, you are reeling out 40 miles of long line, baiting 1,000 hooks, pulling in those 1,000 hooks the next day, and then preparing to put them back out the next morning. It must be incredibly strenuous and sleep depriving.
Sleep deprivation is a big part of the swordfish industry. We're lucky if we get 4 hours a night. You know, the days get long, you know, depending on weather, of course, is the biggest factor. If you're trying to haul the gear in bad weather, it just takes a little bit longer. Every fish, you know, that you stop to bring aboard, a little more difficult to get aboard in bad weather. Part-offs are a huge factor in the length of a day.
It's where the line gets cut, right?
Yes, if you're hauling back the line and you have two or three or five part-offs in a day, each time you have to chase the end, it's time-consuming. A captain can make a bad set and catch a lot of sharks. Very time-consuming. So, yeah, the long days, you know, you're lucky if you get 4 hours sleep.
And how long does a trip last?
We generally keep our trips in sync with the lunar cycle. So a trip is, you know, 28 to 30 days, and that's the goal is to keep on the lunar cycle because the fishing is better because you're fishing these temperature breaks, and the moon obviously affects tide. I guess everyone's aware of that. But these temperature breaks are more defined from the first quarter through the full moon. So we try and do our steaming back and forth to the dock and our turnaround or our time at the dock, unloading, resupplying during the new moon or when you can't see any moon, and our fishing during when you can see a moon.
So you're typically at sea for about a month?
Yes, a typical trip is 30 days.
So when you're reeling in the line, these 1,000 baited leaders, how many swordfish will you typically get?
Oh, the success of a trip just varies so much. I've never been skunked. That means I've never been fishless at the end of a haulback. My biggest day was 107 fish. That's huge. Over 10,000 pounds of fish in one day. If you can average, you know, 3,000 pounds a night, you know, 30 fish, that's a good way to put a trip together. It's a grind. You know, you're going to make 10 or 12 or 20 sets, whatever you need to do to get enough fish to go in with without sort of overdoing the moon thing. You know, you don't want to miss the next moon, so you can't stay out too long, and you don't want your fish to be too old. So, you know, 3,000 pounds a night is a pretty good average.
So 1,000 hooks, 30 fish, and do it again the next day.
Exactly.
Right. So here you are. I mean, you're at very close quarters, working long hours with five or six other people, and you are a woman, which is rare in the business, right?
Yes, it is rare in the business.
I know from reading about you that you started swordfishing, I guess, when you were in college. And I'm just kind of curious, what was it like being a woman at sea? Was it different? Was it difficult?
I fell in love with fishing at the age of 19. I love what I do. And honestly, gender has not been an issue. I started on deck. I worked very hard, had an opportunity to run a boat, came up in the traditional way. You know, I stayed on a boat long enough to become first mate. The owner of the boat bought a second boat. That was my opportunity to become captain. Worked very hard, eventually got good at it. I hire my own crew. A lot of questions are about, you know, men working for a woman. I hire my own guys. Any man that doesn't want to go to sea with a woman hopefully won't ask me for a job. And that's not to say I've never had crew problems, because I have, but they haven't been as a result of my being a woman. Everyone has crew problems at one time or another.
Right. I mean, I guess, you know, you prove yourself and you get the respect that you earn, you know, like people do in any business. On the other hand, I mean, you know, you're commanding a crew of five or six, and I think most of us would think that people who are in commercial fishing are pretty tough guys, salty characters perhaps. Did you feel like you ever had to kind of adopt a persona to, you know, to command these guys, particularly given that it's a strenuous job? You're at close quarters for a month.
Well, most guys really have respect for, especially fishermen, have respect for someone who works hard and is good at what they do. The bottom line is, can I make them a paycheck? Back in my Hannah Bowden days, you know, I was the highliner of the fleet. I'm catching all the fish. My guys are making the most money. Everyone respects that. They don't care if I'm male or female.
Just tell us a little bit more about some of the equipment on the boat.
Most of the equipment in the wheelhouse is pretty high-tech stuff. We have great electronics for forecasting not only weather. We can print our own weather maps. We have satellite receivers like Eye in the Sky. We can, you know, see weather forming, and you just kind of get good at reading that stuff. We also have electronics for fish finding, whether it's a sound machine or something that will show clusters of bait under the surface. Again, satellite pictures of temperature breaks, eddies, ocean features. All of those things are very helpful.
And an ice maker, which is pretty critical, right?
Yes, and when I first started fishing back in 1979, before we'd leave for a trip, we'd blow freshwater ice aboard the boat into the fish hold, and that is how we'd pack the fish. Now every boat has a saltwater ice machine. We make our own ice out of seawater. It's 4 degrees colder than freshwater ice, and it just keeps the fish so much nicer. It doesn't freeze them, but it's really difficult to tell what we consider the top of the trip, which is the last fish caught, from the bottom of the trip, which would be the first fish caught. Just really nice quality fish if you treat them right and pack them properly in saltwater ice.
We're speaking with Linda Greenlaw. She is a writer and captain of a sword fishing boat. She has a new book called Seaworthy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Your latest book, Seaworthy, is about your coming back to sword boat fishing after spending 10 years off, right? You went ashore, did some lobster fishing, wrote 6 books. What pulled you back to the deep water?
When I got done sword fishing the first time, I wasn't really retiring, or I didn't think that I was. I always had an idea that I would go back to it after going lobstering, you know, going home for a while, kind of touching base with the other world. And through this 10-year period, I had opportunities to go sword fishing. I mean, somebody would call and say, hey, you know, this boat's in Newfoundland or Puerto Rico. The crew's all ready. All you have to do is jump aboard and go. While I always wanted to do it, I never could. It's like, you know, I have 800 lobster traps in the water, or I'm in the middle of a book tour. I can't drop everything and go jump on this boat. And as time marched on, it seemed less and less likely that I'd ever get back to what I've always considered my first love of sword fishing. Well, a couple of years ago, the phone rang, and the timing was right. So I said, you know, if I don't do it now, I'm never doing it. So I jumped in head first, and It was a great experience getting back to it, and I fished again last season, and I can't wait to go again this season.
So what is it that you love so much?
I like the way I feel when I'm at sea, and I am passionate about catching fish. And I've learned through the years that the things that I really love about being in this very separate world are probably the same things that I dislike. Total solitude, being absolutely self-reliant and responsible for your entire world with very little input. I'm on a boat at sea, you know, sometimes 1,000 miles from the closest dock with 4 or 5 guys. And, you know, that's your entire world. There's very little contact with anything outside of that world.
Right. There's a section there where you say that when you're out there, you're not You're not thinking about whether you've got a dentist's appointment or what's happening in Congress. It's all how much fuel do I have left? What's the weather? Those kinds of things.
Yeah, we definitely have a different way of marking time at sea. I've never worn a wristwatch. I mean, we mark time by where the moon is. How many sets have we made? How much bait do we have left? So it's a totally different way of living life.
All right. So when you come back to sea after 10 years, the vessel that you command, the Seahawk, is not the pride of the long line fleet, really. Tell us about it.
Oh, boy. I couldn't believe it when I reached New Bedford. My crew had been around the dock working on the boat for a week before I arrived, and they couldn't wait to show me the boat because it was such a disaster. Hadn't fished in a while. The last captain had died at sea. The boat was for sale. It had been dry docked. It had been pretty much scavenged by other boats. You know, hey, this boat's not going fishing again. They don't need this. They don't need that. So we had very little to work with. And, looking back, I can say maybe I was foolish agreeing to take the boat after I saw the state of disrepair. But, you know, we got through it. And they say that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So I'm sure my crew and I are stronger for having fished the Seahawk for 56 days.
Right. I mean, you had all kinds of problems. I mean, the diesel engine conked out and you had to get towed to a Canadian town for repairs. And the ice maker went out at another occasion and all kinds of issues.
I believe that if this trip aboard the Seahawk had been my first trip as captain, I would never have gone back fishing. It was just a 56-day epic disaster. There wasn't, you know, a whole lot good going on. Some of the problems were, you know, created by us, and other problems were, you know, a function of Mother Nature.
Right. Well, we mentioned that. The diesel engine conked out at one point, so you had to get towed and then get it repaired. And then the ice machine went out, and there were electrical problems. One of your crew members was shocked, you know, by touching a light switch that was poorly wired. And then there was this disaster involving you drifting into Canadian waters. What happened there?
Yes, that's actually a big part of Seaworthy is I was arrested. I made a legal set, my first set of my comeback trip. And
a set meaning you laid your 40 miles line of hooks and leaders, right?
Yes, I set my 40 miles of line and leaders in international water, which is where we fish. I set very close to the Canadian line, knowing that my gear was going to drift away from that line. Canada has a 200-mile limit. We're not allowed to fish north of that line. That's Canadian water. And they patrol it and protect it as they should. Well, I made my set and went to bed and got up the next morning, grabbed the end, very enthusiastic, couldn't wait to see what we were going to catch, started hauling the gear, and as I stated before, it's all hands on deck. It was a very long day. We started catching sharks, and we had a few part-offs, and at some point, I think it was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we were buzzed by a Canadian fisheries airplane. I didn't really think much of it, because they do patrol the area very, you know, stringently. They buzzed us again. And then the third time they buzzed us, I said to the guys, you know, I really probably should go up to the wheelhouse just to see what's going on. They may be trying to get me on the radio. When I went up to the wheelhouse and I looked at the chart plotter, which shows our position on an electronic chart, and I nearly threw up because the plotter showed my position 4 miles north of the Canadian line. I was 4 miles into Canadian territory. So I knew I was in big trouble. Then I picked up the radio and called the plane. At that point, not having any idea how something like that could have happened. I know the way the Gulf Stream moves. I know the way the Labrador Current moves. There's absolutely no way that my line could have drifted north. I did a drift test before setting the line. You know, knocked the boat out of gear and saw which way we were drifting. There was no wind to speak of to affect my gear. Long story short, I was arrested and the boat was seized and we were taken to St. John's, Newfoundland. I was handcuffed and led to jail.
How did you figure out how this had happened, how your line had drifted in a way that would have seemed impossible?
After I was released from jail and went back out fishing, a friend of mine was steaming to come fishing, and he stumbled upon a piece of gear floating. And he called on the radio, wanted to know who had lost a piece of gear, and I knew it was mine. And he brought it aboard his boat and called me back on the radio and said, yes, you know, it says Seahawk on the beeper buoy, and it's been run over by a ship. There's bottom paint all over it. So I then knew that my gear had been run over by a ship and towed across the line into, you know, illegal fishing territory. So that answered a question for me, you know, how did that happen? So I go to court several months later and was found guilty on the charges of illegal entry and illegal fishing. Was a very, I say innocent, but expensive mistake.
$35,000 Canadian fine, right, as I recall.
Yes, that's correct.
Linda Greenlaw speaking with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. Greenlaw is the author of the new memoir, Seaworthy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with Linda Greenlaw, the only woman captain of a sword fishing boat in the U.S. Her new memoir, Seaworthy, is about her return to the deep sea after a 10-year hiatus, during which she set lobster traps and wrote books. Dave and Linda Greenlaw had been talking about her first deep sea fishing trip after that hiatus aboard the Seahawk. It was 56 days of trouble, including engine breakdowns, ice maker malfunctions, and her arrest for inadvertently trespassing and fishing in Canadian waters.
So you managed to eventually get released from a Canadian jail and get back to your boat, and you get back out and you start fishing again. Once you're fishing again, other issues arise, including a terrible incident when you're in some rough weather. And I thought I'd have you read a passage here about this moment where a crew member of yours named Machado, whose job is to clean and cut the heads off the swordfish and clean them as they come up. And at this point, you're in so much – you're bringing in the lines, but the sea is so rough that – waves keep crashing over the onto the deck, and meaning that the fish are floating, and he's trying to wrestle them down and cut them up. You're all having a terrible time. And remember, there's this little door cut in a part of the side of the boat there where you can bring the fish up. I wonder if you could just read this this little passage about what happens as things get worse.
Sure, and I'd love to do that. And just as you were saying, this was a really severe day of weather. So we were all struggling. I was struggling to keep the boat on the gear. Machado was really struggling chasing. We were catching fish, which was great, but the fish are, you know, washing rail to rail with the water. Really difficult. So I will read. Just as I had the boat back on the gear properly, we took the worst wallop yet. Green water pounded the hull smack on our beam and cascaded like a giant waterfall over the rail. When the boat rolled to starboard, the volume of water collected and rushed that way, taking all that was in its path with it. My back was pressed securely against the side of the forecastle, and I planted my feet to brace myself and avoid becoming part of the reaction. The boat rolled back to port, and the torrent buckled my knees briefly. I recovered and looked aft to see two fish slide toward the open door, followed closely by Machado, who was floundering flat on his belly and quite helpless. The first fish went through the door and overboard. Machado's eyes were like saucers as he headed toward the opening through which the fish had just vanished. Although everything was happening at high speed, my memory of Machado is in slow motion. His arms and legs were spiraling, much like the limbs of a turtle stuck on its back and struggling to right itself, to no avail. Thinking back, I imagine Machado as an astronaut out of gravity's grasp. Machado's expression was a perfect picture of sheer terror as he looked desperately for something to grab to save himself. A second fish splashed through the door that was now acting as a funnel for the deluge of exiting water. There was no doubt in my mind that Machado would immediately follow the fish, and there wasn't a thing I could do to stop him. I threw the boat out of gear to avoid moving away too quickly or chopping him up in the propeller should the boat be blown down on top of him. I wondered if one of the guys could throw the life ring quickly and accurately enough. Suddenly, just as Machado's head went over the threshold, Timmy appeared from out of nowhere. He dove onto Machado, pinning him hard to the steel deck and stopping him, just short of being a goner.
Is that as close as you've ever come to losing a crew member at sea?
That is absolutely as close as I've ever come to losing somebody overboard. The weather was just so severe that if Machado had followed the fish through the door, there's very little chance that we'd have been able to save him. I mean, I could barely keep the boat on the gear, and thinking that you'd be able to get the boat back to a man who's in full oil gear. He's not even going to stay on the surface very long. The wind's blowing so hard, how do you even throw a life ring? I mean, a life ring is like sort of like a frisbee, you know, in the wind. Good luck with that. So it was extremely scary and, you know, obviously a very close call. And although I enjoyed writing about it, I don't enjoy that image sort of over and over in my mind of Machado going towards the open door.
And how was Machado?
Machado was shaken, you know, as I think anyone would be. He was a pretty unhappy camper. I don't think anybody likes to see their own life flash before their eyes. Machado had been going to sea for a long time, and he knew as well as I did that if he had gone through that door, it probably would have been the end of him.
Do you know if he went back out after this voyage?
I know that Machado did not make a trip after that. In fact, we landed our fish in Newfoundland at the end of that trip, and Machado was on a plane home. He's gainfully employed in Boston. He is a fish dealer. So he's still dealing with fish, but he's not on the boat doing it. He takes care of them after we land him at the dock.
I'd like you to tell one story that you relate in the book about a case where you saw a swordfish take on a shark.
Early in my sword fishing career, we fished on George's Banks, and part of the fishery that we were doing was harpooning, which is the most incredibly fun and exciting fishery. It's a sight fishery. My part of that was being the helmsman. I climb up the mast, I'm in the crow's nest, I'm driving the boat from up there and looking for fish swimming on the surface of the ocean. It's one fish. You know, you're not seeing schools of fish. You're looking around for a single fish. Well, this particular day, I was up in the crow's nest. I saw fins. And I was like, wow, all right, cool. I put the boat in gear, and the captain's running out to the end of the stand or the pulpit from where you throw the harpoon. And as we approach the fins, which kept disappearing, I noticed that there were two sets of fins. One set of fins was a swordfish and a big one. And the second set of fins was a gigantic mako shark. Well, we watched a struggle between a mako shark and a swordfish, and the captain of the boat is wanting me to get the boat onto the mako shark so we can harpoon the shark, or the swordfish so we can harpoon the swordfish. We get up to the shark, harpoon it, and then look around for the fish. The fish is gone. And, of course, we're very disappointed. The fish is gone. A little while later, the fins pop up. Bang. Nope, we miss it. Fish is gone. So we missed a big fish. It was a huge fish. It was really a day saver. We really needed that fish. So we haul back the shark, get the shark on the deck. It's a big mako. And the guy cleaning the shark is just amazed at this little tiny baby swordfish that was in the shark's belly. And suddenly I felt okay about this big swordfish getting away, because I had a feeling that the swordfish and the shark were fighting or, you know, struggling together. The swordfish was upset. I mean, the shark ate the swordfish's baby. So I felt good about killing the shark, and I felt kind of okay about the swordfish getting away.
Are you headed back out to the deep water soon, or are you going to write another book? What's next for you?
A little bit of each. I will be writing another book. And August 1st, I am heading back to sea on the Hannah Bowden. I'm going to get my old boat back, which I'm just ecstatic about.
Linda Greenlaw, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Linda Greenlaw spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Her new memoir is called Seaworthy, A Swordboat Captain Returns to the Sea. You can read a chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org. The American West would look very different today without Hoover Dam. By harnessing the Colorado River, the dam brought water and hydroelectricity to Los Angeles, Phoenix, Denver, Salt Lake City, and San Diego. But cities that owe their evolution to the dam have also become its prisoners, writes Michael Hiltzik in his new book, Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century. He says, as astonishing and durable as the dam has proven to be, a modern perspective requires us to ask dark questions, including whether it was right to even build the dam. His book examines the architecture, politics, and environmental impact of Hoover Dam. Hiltzik is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has written for the L.A. Times for more than 20 years. Michael Hiltzik, welcome to Fresh Air. When I went to see the Hoover Dam, I was expecting to not be very interested. I was nearby, so I figured I'd stop by and take a look. It was amazing. It was just so architecturally amazing. I just found it overwhelming. Do you want to describe for our listeners who haven't seen the Hoover Dam what the experience is like and what it looks like?
Sure. It's this beautiful, smooth wedge of alabaster concrete set in the middle of this harsh gorge in the most unforgiving landscape you can imagine. And it's got this machine beauty. It's a great exemplar of a style of architecture that became very popular in the 20s and 30s, machine age architecture. So it projects this great bulk and this great power, and at the same time, it's got a tremendous elegance. And that was the product of its architect, its exterior architect, a man named Gordon Kaufman, who was brought in to do that. And Kaufman looked at the original plans for the dam, which were full of all sorts of decoration and architectural gingerbread, and he stripped that all away. And what he left is this sort of svelte, elegant product that really is striking in this harsh, rough-hewn environment.
So looking at the Hoover Dam, what did Herbert Hoover actually have to do with the creation of the Hoover Dam?
Herbert Hoover's role in creating the dam is really equivocal, and so equivocal that when his name was placed on the dam by his own interior secretary, that was a very controversial step. But he did have a very important role very early in the dam project, and that was when the seven states had to come together and reach an interstate compact, an interstate treaty. They sat down. These were seven states that had been squabbling over water rights on the river for 20 years. Hoover was Commerce Secretary at the time. He was appointed by his president, Warren Harding, to serve as sort of adult supervision of these negotiations. And he really managed the negotiations so that they got a compact in 1922. Now, without that, Congress would never have approved the dam. So it was really crucial. So his role can't be minimized. But in later years, he overstated his role because he understood that this was such a magnificent project and such an important project that he wanted to make sure that his role was well understood.
Hoover Dam was built in spite of the public utility companies. The Federal Trade Commission exposed that the utilities tried to prevent the dam from being built back in the 1920s. What was the utilities' campaign to prevent the dam from being built?
The utilities at the time that the dam was being conceived had already been engaged in a 10 or 20-year campaign against public power. Now, Los Angeles had really drawn a line in the sand against the private utilities by seizing the power grid of the Edison Company and operating it as a municipal utility. And the private utilities were very concerned that once a dam like Hoover Dam was built, because it would be producing so much hydroelectricity, that the power it produced would become a benchmark for their pricing and their rates and their methods of distribution. And that's one thing they really did not want to happen. But there was a very powerful campaign for public power at the same time. And over the years, the utilities and the public power advocates fought tooth and nail to gain advantage over each other. Now, the utilities, they spent millions upon millions of dollars to defeat not only Hoover Dam, but the Muscle Shoals project in the east, which became part of the TVA. They paid for textbooks to be written to promote the advantages of private power. They paid off college professors. They bribed lawmakers in state houses and in Congress with thousands upon thousands of dollars. And they did this all sub rosa. They created all sorts of front organizations that had to be investigated before you understood that these were really utility fronts. And as you said, it was the Federal Trade Commission, much to everybody's surprise, because the FTC was not known as an aggressive regulator, that finally exposed all this.
So what happened after it was exposed?
Well, it was such an embarrassment for lawmakers to be exposed as having taken bribes from the private utilities that exposure actually helped the dam get approved by Congress. It was touch and go right up to the point that all of these disclosures came out, and these disclosures really tipped the scales.
The building of Hoover Dam, and this was the largest federal contract ever, coincides with the Great Depression. So what impact did the Depression have on the building of the dam?
It's important to understand that the dam was not originally conceived as a Depression-era project. Its conception goes all the way back to 1905, when Southern California was subjected to terrible floods from the Colorado River. And then the efforts to get it approved by Congress really started back in the early 20s. But when the Depression started and Herbert Hoover was president, one of the programs that he did believe in terms of fighting unemployment was to build up public works. He urged states and municipalities to step up their construction, and he was willing to put federal money behind federal projects. Now, at the time, federal construction budget was tiny. It was $150 million a year. Hoover Dam, or the Boulder Canyon Dam Project, as it was known at the time, was going to cost $165 million all by itself. But when Hoover wanted to jumpstart a public works program, he looked around, and because the federal budget was so small, there weren't a lot of shovel-ready projects, to use a current term. But there was this dam project, which had been approved by Congress. The project had been signed into law by Calvin Coolidge. The engineering had all been done. So he cleared the way. The dam wasn't going to be started until sometime in the mid-30s, but Hoover ordered it started early in 1930.
Hoover Dam has an incredible amount of concrete, and it's just amazingly and beautifully poured and designed, and it's almost hallucinatory when you gaze down from on top of the dam and you see the slope of the concrete and the symmetry of it. As remarkable as Hoover Dam is as a work of design and architecture, part of it actually really didn't work, and this is like the grout curtain, and you'll have to describe what the grout curtain is. But this part had to be rebuilt, and you say it was rebuilt kind of secretly because they didn't want the public to know that there was such a massive problem.
That's true, and this is something that still doesn't get talked about very much. It's well known to the engineering community, and it's well known to anybody who looks at the technical records of the dam, because it was necessary to document what they were doing. But essentially, when you build a dam, there's a phenomenon that dam builders understand called uplift. And what happens is that as water seeps under the dam, under the foundations and around the sides, it presses up on the bulk of the dam, and it reduces the dam's effective weight and effectiveness. Now, that was a phenomenon that was very well understood. But what wasn't understood was what the geology really was like underneath the foundations of Hoover Dam. So what happened was that the designers designed what's known as a grout curtain, and that means that they drilled boreholes into the foundations under the dam before the concrete was actually poured, some of them 150 feet deep into the bedrock. And then the idea was to pressure fill them with grout, which is essentially cement and water, so that the grout would penetrate the faults and the cracks and the flaws in the underlying geology and keep water from seeping under the dam and keep uplift from happening. Now, this was such a new technique, and this was such a big dam, that they didn't get the grout curtain right. Workers didn't really understand how important their job was in building and filling the boreholes. So if they ran into problems, if they ran into a void that was taking just too much grout, they would stop. If they ran into a hot spring and the grout quick set, they would stop and they'd move on to the next borehole. So instead of this even line of filled holes, you had what I describe as sort of a mouth with a lot of teeth missing. Now, this wasn't a problem until Lake Mead started filling behind the dam, and the pressure of all that water forced water under the dam and out to the sides, and the dam sprung a leak. It was leaking from the cliff sides. Water was pouring into the galleries inside the dam. They were taking hundreds of buckets out every day. And then when they started measuring the uplift, they really got alarmed because the dam was threatened. The uplift was so bad and the seepage was so great that they feared for the dam's stability.
So they had to redo it?
They had to redo it. They had to go in. They had to rebore all those holes. They bored them three, sometimes four times as deep as they did originally. They made sure that all of the grout got absorbed into the bedrock. And they had to do it, of course. Now the dam is built. They had to do it from the interior galleries. And we've got photographs in the book of some of the workers sharing this tiny space with their pumps and their drills to get that grout curtain done right. But eventually they did, and they were able to reduce the uplift to below the original specifications. But that did take 9 years. It took longer to fix than it took to build the original dam.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Hiltzik, and he's the author of the new book Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century. So after Hoover Dam is completed in 1936, you also have this big man-made lake, Lake Mead, that's created as a result of the dam. And it's the world's largest man-made body of water. You say that the creation of Lake Mead actually affected climate and the weather.
Well, Lake Mead affected more than climate and the weather. Lake Mead, it's the weight of the water in Lake Mead is so great, and of course, it's focused in such a small part of the topography that Lake Mead created earthquakes in that region. So it's not only the climate, but it's the seismic conditions of that region that are affected by Lake Mead.
Yeah, you say the weight of Lake Mead. You say it's 41.5 billion tons of water.
Yes, 41 billion tons of water on a very small patch of land. So, yes, it deforms the crust of the earth underneath.
So is there proof that that's what caused this big 1939 earthquake across the desert floor between Boulder City and Vegas?
I think that's well understood. Seismic experts, yes, they've determined that it wasn't merely the size of Lake Mead, but it was the process of filling it, draining it. That's what created the earthquakes. Now, after some upstream dams were completed and Lake Mead, the filling and draining slowed down, they got a lot fewer earthquakes.
FDR did the dedication when Hoover Dam was open. He presided over the final part of the dam construction. What was his role in the building of the dam?
Well, he had very little role. The dam was, in fact, conceived by Theodore Roosevelt. It was enacted and signed into law by Calvin Coolidge, and then it was launched by Herbert Hoover, all Republican presidents. One of the ironies of the story is that during the 1932 presidential campaign, Roosevelt attacked Hoover for his public work spending. This was all deficit spending. In one famous speech in Pittsburgh during the campaign, Roosevelt really took off after Hoover for overspending the federal budget. Now, of course, once Roosevelt came into office and this was his project, he took full ownership of it. He came out to dedicate it on September 30, 1935, and it was well noticed by Republicans, certainly at the time, that when he dedicated it, the name of Herbert Hoover was never mentioned in a full day of ceremonies. It's important to remember also that within a couple of months after taking office, the Roosevelt administration took Hoover's name off the dam. And for 14 years, the dam was known as Boulder Dam.
And how did Hoover's name get back on it?
Well, Hoover's name got back on it in 1947 when there was a Republican Congress in Washington for the first time in 14 years. Now, at that point, the memories of the Depression had begun to dim, and Hoover himself had – his reputation had improved somewhat. He had resumed his role as a chief of war relief, which was the sort of thing that had brought him to national attention during the First World War. So he had much more of a humanitarian reputation by 1947. So the Republican Congress moved to put his name back on the dam, and Harry Truman, who was president at the time and happened to be a friend of Hoover, decided to get out of the way. So his name was restored, and it's been on that dam ever since.
The building of dams has fallen out of fashion. What are some of the problems that environmentalists now say are created by dams?
Well, this is one of the issues that was never considered when Hoover Dam was being built. But when you dam a river, basically you reduce the flow downstream. That's going to affect wildlife habitats. In certain rivers, you're going to destroy the spawning grounds for fish like salmon. You're going to destroy wetlands. You're really interfering with a lot of ecological balance when you build a dam. That's not the only reason that dams have sort of fallen out of favor. Dams are very expensive, and the water that they provide for users is very expensive water because of the capital expense of building a dam. These days, it's much wiser, it's seen as much wiser, to look for other sources of water supply, including conservation and reclamation. And this is what we try to do now because it's much cheaper, much more efficient, and much more ecologically friendly.
Well, Michael Hiltzik, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Michael Hiltzik is the author of Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century. You can read a chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Minhivar, John Myers, and Lauren Krenzel. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.